Good morning. So my name is Doug Anderson. Mike is hosting, and I'm up here. So if you're confused, I feel your pain. Heather, we can start with first. So a few weeks ago, when Mike was speaking on Genesis 1, I came up and I'm the astronomy guy, and I showed you some pictures I've taken from COMOX of some things in space. We won't darken the light, so it's not quite as impressive. But you can see the Horsehead Nebula here. Here's the Andromeda Galaxy. Go ahead, Heather. Number two, Andromeda Galaxy, much farther away. And then here's three little galaxies very far away. We were trying to get a sense of the space of space, right? And let's go, and we'll rest here for a moment. Does anyone know what this is? Sorry? No. No. But excellent try. I'm supposed to. Right, it's always, that was a great question. And then we're in political season right now. So at any rate, so Micah had mentioned that we can go big or we can go very small. This is actually called a cloud chamber photo. And this is when nuclear physicists, now this is stuff I don't know as much about as I know about astronomy, which is very small. But in particle accelerators, scientists take the tiniest little particles, protons and atoms, and they whip them around in these particle accelerators, and they cause them to clash. And this collision produces other objects that we'd never known about. We thought the atom was indivisible, but in fact, they can't even see these things, so they use these little things called cloud chambers, and now these have been replaced by other ways of seeing these structures. But you get this beautiful cascading effect of these tiny little particles that are radiating out from this collision of these tiny things. And these are so small, we can't, even with an electron microscope, you can't see them because these things are as small as electrons. So we can see the big things and we can see the small things. Thanks, Heather. You can shut that off for now. So there is no denying the wonder of both the massive and the vast universe and the infinitesimally small universe. But we live lives very much in the middle, between these extremes. For all its power in describing things and explaining mechanisms, science doesn't seem to help us understand what life is all about. What does it all mean? Or does it mean anything? When I was traveling a few years ago on a long flight, I was excited to see that among the movie choices was the classic film from 1955, Rebel Without a Cause, starring James Dean. I'd never seen it before. It's kind of hard to find. But we all know the title, right? The initial scenes take place in a police station where we meet three teenagers, each having gotten into some sort of trouble. The common thread for each of them is the loss of parental authority. That is, the loss of parental moral authority. They have lost respect for their parents, who they see as vapid, overprotective, empty hypocrites. Seeing his father through the window, James Dean's character screams, "I don't ever want to be like him." The next scene in the movie got all excited as they went. They were back at school and they went on a field trip to Griffith Observatory for a planetarium showing. Astronomy, cool, right? The kids snort and joke as the scientist sort of leads them through a story of the universe. Suddenly it all turns serious when, with a flash of lights and a swell of dissonant music, he describes the eventual cataclysmic end of the universe, with everything destroyed in a burst of gas and fire. These kids, now struck dumb, it occurred to me, were old enough to remember the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This scientist, this last remaining authority figure in their lives, explains how the universe will be left a cold, dead place. The Earth, he says, will not be missed. And from this perspective, the problems of humans are trivial and naive indeed. This is a classic example, a classic overreach, common among some scientists and some people in our culture, of overstating what we can know from science and smuggling in their own religious beliefs as if they were science. He is telling the story that in the end, there is no meaning to life, only lonely voices that will eventually go silent. I love the last lines delivered, the last lines of his speech delivered with the gravitas of an old school preacher. And man existing alone, he says, seems himself an episode of little consequence. That's all. Thank you for your attention. It's kind of like, I've just gutted all of your hopes and dreams and any reasons you might have for living. Please remember to visit the gift shop. Washrooms are on the left. As New Testament scholar Rick Watts says many times in the Reframe program, we live out of our stories. These teenagers go on in the film to live out lives of risk-taking, violence, and an empty search for meaning. They are cast as tragic heroes in the face of absurdity. For these rebels, there is no cause. Here's a rhetorical question. Why do you think this film has such stature in our culture? So is this rebel without a cause story the only story out of which we can live? If life does have meaning, there must be some connection between the universe, both vast and tiny, whatever creative power created it, and our actual particular lives lived in particular places, in particular times, our personal loves and losses. There must be some sort of bridge between heaven and earth. What is it, or perhaps who is it, that connects heaven and earth? In the last few weeks, Mike has walked us through some of the foundational stories of Genesis. These are the foundational stories of our faith, how we understand ourselves and the world, and they set the stage for God's work in our world. In these early chapters of Genesis, we've seen many things, among them, that before there was anything, there was God. We have seen the creation of a good world, a creation that is under God, loved by God. We have seen the creation of humanity, the image bearers of God, their communion with God and with each other, their mandate to care for the earth. We have seen the presence of evil, the temptation to rebel against God, to be one's own God, and the harm that comes from this rejection of God. We have seen the subtle way that evil twists the good. It gets into our hearts and undermines the peace and fullness of the garden, eventually leaving Adam and Eve and us alone outside of the garden. We have seen that these stories are not just stories about someone or some other time. All the while in the background, we have seen that there are promises and clues that God will work to redeem what has fallen, humanity and all the earth, the cosmos, in fact, to restore the communion and shalom of his creation. That also being God's redemptive story is also our story. In today's passage, as you've heard, we continue on this story, which is mostly tragic, and we too will look for signs that God is working to restore his creation. So we arrive at the story of Cain and Abel. As the scene opens up, we find ourselves with Adam and Eve, now outside of the garden, that place of security, of bounty, of love and communion with God. They are standing instead on the barren, dry soil, swords flashing in the distance, reminding them that they will never return to Eden. They have learned that in pain, Eve will bear children, and that their relationship will now be a power struggle, complicated and disappointing. This ground where they stand is cursed soil, which will produce thorns and thistles, and will require toil and sweat to produce any life-sustaining crops. They have gone from an all-inclusive resort. Yes, a gym, not a spa, right, Micah? But they've gone from an all-inclusive resort, literally a paradise, a summer camp retreat love fest, now, to a BYO everything, non-event, canceled Woodstock, in the desert. And by the way, you are the janitor, the benefits have run out, there is no pay, and it's all your fault. Welcome. Not only that, but this same soil will one day open up to swallow their own dead bodies, because out of it they were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. We will see in a moment that they are not the first to die. So Adam and Eve do what most disappointed people do. They get on with life and have a couple of kids. First comes Cain, a farmer, and next Abel, a shepherd. At some point, these brothers each bring an offering to God. The story doesn't tell us anything about this proto-religion, what their relationship to God is now. What does post-Eden prayer and worship look like? We know that ancient cultures all over the world have practices and beliefs about gods and sin and sacrifice and blood. There seems to be something very deep in the human heart, a need for justice, for approval, for honor, for humility before something greater, however messed up this often becomes. At some point, both these brothers bring offerings to God. We have to infer from the text that Cain sort of grabbed a few things off the shelf of his storehouse. He maybe didn't put his heart into it. Maybe he was eager to get rid of that odd handmade craft his aunt gave him, or maybe that homemade wine that he had been waiting to re-gift to someone else. Abel, however, had taken the effort to actually give the Lord the best of what he had. This secondborn son is careful to give the firstborn of his flock the best fat portions. It appears that he had a sense of reverence, a desire to give this creator God something that represented how much Abel felt he was worth, to give worth, to truly worship God. In any case, we hear that God accepted Abel's gift, but had no regard for Cain's gift. Cain is ticked off. He is mad that he has been shown up by his little brother. So begins the first and not the last sibling rivalry. It's interesting to note how often the most intense rivalries occur between people who are very close. I have two older brothers and a younger sister. So for me, my biggest rival was my next older brother. We were both middle children, but as he was 4 years older than me, growing up, he won any contest, argument, or fight. The irony was not lost on me when a few years ago, I heard that they had chosen a special day, International Middle Child's Day. International Middle Child's Day. And guess what? It's on his birthday. Brothers, sisters, co-workers, neighbors, people at the same church can especially be tempted to become rivals because they share common stories and worldviews, and they cross-pollinate ideas, wants, desires, and skills. At first, it's flattering, and then it quickly becomes really annoying when someone copies you a lot, right? There are serious moral and spiritual hidden traps for both the imitator and the person being imitated in these situations. When we get locked into a rivalry, the foreground is all about the other person. We spend time criticizing them, finding faults, hoping for their ruin. The background, however, is all about us, our need for attention, importance, control. Another version of this is the scapegoat, that person or group that needs to wear the blame so that others can come out smelling like roses. Insecurity plays into this. When we aren't sure where we stand, when we aren't sure if we are good enough or what we are worth, it is very helpful to have someone nearby that we can favorably compare ourselves to so that we can rest in the knowledge that we are better than them. It is often handy for rivals to join together to scapegoat another. Having a common enemy brings them a kind of truce peace as they bully the innocent outsider. At any rate, we see dear Cain at the crossroads of action, but the deeper story of his heart seems already set. We hear in the story that God speaks to Cain, and not surprisingly, he has some good advice for him. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, it's contrary to you, but you must rule over it." Let's compare what the serpent said to Eve in the garden about sin. The crafty beast told her, "You will not die. You will be like God." Take it from me, this is the worst ever advice about sin. Take it from me, here's the best ever advice about sin. Sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is contrary to you. You must rule over it. Sin, that thing we do, that feels like it will be so good, that will express our anger, that will feed our desire, that will put us back on top where we belong. Sin is not our friend. It does not want the best for us. It will eat us alive from the inside. And on the outside, sin begins a chain reaction of harm to ourselves and others. Sin's desire is contrary to us, as God says. It doesn't free us. It wants us in servitude, as slaves. sitting by the fireplace calmly battle so often we fail. But sin is not just a thing we do. It is for us, as with Adam and Eve and now their family, a state we are in. Sin is the air we breathe, the ground we walk on. It is our postal code. It is the way we think, feel, and react. It is the way we plan, choose, and act. It is the state of our hearts. Get away from me, Peter says to Jesus when he sees his glory, right? I am a sinful man. If Adam cracked open the door to sin, Cain swung it wide open. In cold blood, Cain finds a moment out in the field and in violence kills his brother Abel. The peace that was Eden is shattered even further. Murder is now a thing. People are killing each other. Not only that, the heart is further hardened to God. Let's compare Adam and Cain a bit further. When God asks Adam, why is he hiding? Adam confesses. This newly created, now newly sinning person is somewhat naive, like a child, quick to say what he did wrong. Cain, on the other hand, is a thoroughly modern sinner. When asked, where is your brother? He says, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Right? He denies it and makes a sarcastic comment. This is a big step away from God. Adam had been moved out of Eden into a harder world. Cain now moves himself into solitude. He refuses to talk honestly with God. So Cain, our rebel with a cause, has decided it is all about him. His cause is himself. And yet there is justice. God is a God of justice. The voice of your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground, God tells Cain. To me, this is chilling. From here on, how much blood will be spilled into the earth? How many innocents are to be harmed? How many scapegoats will there be in history? The earth itself withdraws from Cain and from us. The ground is now doubly cursed. God orders Cain now to move on to Nod, the land of wandering, to be indeed a wanderer. There's a sense now in which Cain will now always wander, never to have a home. Cain has separated himself from home, from the God in whom we find our home. He is now untethered. He's drifting. Also, Cain now fears for his life. He fears someone will do to him what he has done to another. That's a pretty good definition of sin right there. But even in this, God is not absent. As has been said, God continues to work with and in what is happening to move his story of redemption forward. Or as Micah said last week, grace slips in blessing ahead of sin. God marks Cain and thereby protects him. No one is to kill him. Not only that, God allows Cain to become the father of culture makers, musicians, and forgers of iron and bronze. Cain is homeless and wandering in the spiritual sense, but he establishes the first city, Enoch, named after his son. The garden was meant to be a place of flourishing, but even after the fall, God allows the gifts of culture and community to develop in the city. Here will be the mixed blessings of the city. Here will be trade, knowledge, and invention. Here will be the isolation and loneliness of city life, the consumption, the inhumanity, and the waste. The downward spiral continues. Later in chapter 4, we hear about Lamech, a descendant of Cain in every respect, who collects wives and kills with little provocation and brags about it. Things have gotten pretty bad. I sense a flood coming. And yet God is not done, not nearly done. As we shall see, the story hasn't even begun yet. Meanwhile, back with Adam and Eve, they have another son, Seth, through whose family line will come Noah. But that is another story. So to conclude, I want to spend a moment reflecting on three statements. First, God asking Adam, where are you? Secondly, God asking Cain, where is your brother? And I want to compare these with much later in the Bible when Pontius Pilate presenting Jesus to the crowd before his crucifixion, when he says, rather dramatically, behold the man. Let's read that from John 19. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again to the crowd and said, "See, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." So first statement, Adam, where are you? God says. God is God. He knows the answer. Adam in his sin is hiding. Adam has sinned. Where is he now, really? Where is he? He can't even answer. He is lost, so lost. He has done it. He has failed. Where are we when we are distanced from God? Where are we when we are bound up in our little stories, our fears and failures? Where are you, God asks? Where are we, really? We have no answer. We can't even speak. Who will answer for us? Who will stand in our place? Secondly, God says, "Cain, where is your brother?" God is God. He knows the answer. He knows where Abel is. Cain, in his sin, is ignoring God. Where is the person you hurt? What is the harm you have done? Where is the bond you had as brothers, as sisters? Why the petty grievances, the rivalry, the rebellion? How do we repair what is broken? Where is your brother, God asks. We have no answer. We can't even speak. Who will answer for us? Who will stand in our place? And finally, Pontius Pilate, the man who represented Roman power in Israel, presents Jesus to the angry crowd. This Jesus, bleeding from a crown of thorns, beaten, dehumanized, made an object of scorn. He bears the weight of sin, but he is the sacrifice. This man who is a man and yet is God, he is the bridge between creator and creation. The one through whom and in whom everything was made, the farthest flung galaxies, the tiniest atomic subparticles. The Ancient of Days was made a babe in a manger. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh. This Jesus, the second Adam, the seed of Abraham, the son of David, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, the one who brings the promise of new life, new hearts, new love. Where are you? Where is your brother? God asks. We have no answer. We can't even speak. Who will answer for us? Who will